Good morning. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. I'm Susie Jones, your host, along with Charlie Weiss at the helm, and we're happy to have you listening this morning to our Health Hour. We dedicate this hour each and every week to issues involving your health, whether it's mental health, physical health, all facets of health. And this morning we're going to talk about women's health. What do we really know about it? We know about breast cancer, of course, that's quite in the news, and screenings, mammograms, pregnancy, often talked about, but there's so much more. And joining us today to give a little bit more insight into what we all need to know about women's health is Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. Good morning. Thank you for coming on with us. We really appreciate your time today.
Good morning, Susie. I'm so happy to be here. So excited to talk about women's health.
Well, I think as women, it's pretty well documented that we tend to put ourselves last, particularly mothers, you know, with young children, we sort of get third or fourth on the list of things to do. What about women and some key screenings that we should all be aware of, and maybe kind of which age bracket? So talk a little bit about getting that PAP test. I know that is pretty critical to finding a lot of things. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. And, you know, and I just want to take a moment to say that, you know, I see screening tests as a way to prevent disease. We often think about our screening tests like the PAP test as a way to prevent cancer, which they can. But I also want to remind our listeners that the number one cause of death in women is cardiovascular disease. So it's so important that women establish with a physician for their annual exams, and first just to check their blood pressure and weight. And then for most women, that PAP test is a very important component of that exam to screen for cervical cancer. And so what's involved with the PAP test, you know, it's changed over the past decade or so. It is a simple test in which cells are gently collected from the cervix and then sent to a lab for evaluation. When should women get a PAP test? You know, cervical cancer screening should be done based on age. And today, for the most part, we're going to talk about average risk women. So starting at age 21, women should have a PAP test every 3 years. In this time frame, in this age range, rather, it's just a PAP test alone. After the age of 30, women of average risk can be screened one of two ways. They can receive a PAP test every 3 years or a PAP test with HPV testing, also known as co-testing, every 5 years. Cervical cancer screening does not need to be performed in women who've had a hysterectomy and no longer have a cervix. And again, in average risk women, we stop cervical cancer screening at the age of 65.
And at what point after 65 do you stop getting a PAP completely?
You do, and that's because we know the risk of cervical cancer after the age of 65 is fairly low.
Okay.
That's because cervical cancer is caused by a virus called HPV. That virus is primarily transmitted sexually. And so that doesn't mean that some women over the age of 65 should not get PAPs, but women, again, of average risk who don't have a history of abnormal PAP tests may discontinue cervical cancer screening at 65. I also want to remind our listeners that that doesn't mean you don't need to see a gynecologist or your primary care doctor for a pelvic exam. We do not have screening tests for uterine or ovarian cancer, so that pelvic exam is important every year, even if you don't need a PAP test.
Mm, okay, that's good to know. I think, again, there's somewhat of some confusion about whether what age and when you stop and what you should get. I think the pelvic exam is a little bit new to me, particularly because I thought, well, if I'm this old, I don't need a PAP. So that's good to know. Listen, let's let our listeners involved in this as well, because they really do enjoy jumping in with questions or comments. And our talk and text line is 651-461-9226. Remember, you can call at any time. Again, we're talking to Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health, about some things that we don't think about and what we need to remember, whether it's ourselves or our loved ones. I know we talk a lot about getting that annual mammogram. I get a little note as to when my time is up. How critical is the mammogram every year, and or how often should a woman be getting a mammogram?
right? So a mammogram is critical to early detection of breast cancer. And early detection is critical to, women who unfortunately are diagnosed with breast cancer living a long, healthy life. And so the American College of OBGYNs recommends that average-risk women have a mammogram starting at age 40 and then annually thereafter. Again, based on your family history or other risk factors, you may need to start screening sooner. But if you're at average risk, that means you have a risk of breast cancer that is 1 in 8 or 12%. But getting that mammogram at age 40 will often result in early detection, which really saves lives. So I can't stress enough how important it is for women to start that mammogram at age 40 and then do one every year when they are due.
All right, very good. And you talked about mammograms, pap tests, and colon cancer screenings. That's one that people sort of shudder at. No one likes to get a colonoscopy. I know I had mine at, I think I was 50, and I don't have, I don't know how often you get a colonoscopy.
Well, it is sometimes a challenging conversation, but colon cancer is the third leading cause of death in women in the U.S. And again, early detection offers a five-year survival rate of around 90%. Unfortunately, only about a third of colon cancers are detected early. And I think that's, again, because of the fear that women have of the colonoscopy. Recently, colon cancer screening, again, in average risk individuals has changed to age 45. And so the recommendation, the gold standard, is to have a colonoscopy. For the most part, patients or people may complain about what's called the prep, and that's the process by which the colon is cleaned out. But after that, you're generally sedated, and a small camera is inserted to visualize the colon. What I like to tell patients about a colonoscopy is it allows physicians to remove polyps that could go on to develop into a cancer and then just make sure that the colon looks healthy. There are other tests that are not invasive or can be done at home, called the FIT or the Cologuard. They're not as effective as a colonoscopy. Again, you're not visualizing the colon. You can't remove polyps. But for patients that are resistant to having a colonoscopy, they do offer an opportunity for screening for colon cancer. If your Cologuard or your FIT test returns positive, the recommendation is to have a colonoscopy. Again, it's so important that women establish with a primary care provider or an OBGYN, because these are important conversations to have based on your risk factors. Your provider can explain the procedures, and hopefully you can build that trust so that you don't have the apprehension around some of these screening tests.
651-461-9226. That is our talk and text line. We do have a question. A listener reporting in today wanted to talk a little bit about having bladder issues as an older woman. Is that something you see a fair amount of in the world of women's health?
Yes, and I'm so grateful for this question, because I think that over the years, women have become more vocal about some of these concerns. I think decades ago, women would experience urinary incontinence, which, is a result of normal aging. It can be the result of hormonal shifts that occur with menopause. It can be the result of childbearing. Sometimes it can be the result of chronic lung conditions like COPD, where a patient or a woman is coughing a great deal. And so if you're having issues with urgency or leakage, it's important to establish with a physician. And then there are specialists called urogynecologists that can do testing to determine what exactly is the issue. And there are a number of treatment options, some as conservative as pelvic floor physical therapy, and others that include surgical options, some minimally invasive. So it's important to have that conversation, because women should not feel as though that they have to live with those symptoms.
All right, very good. We're going to take our first break of the hour. It is 17 minutes past 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Again, our guest is Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. And we invite your calls and your texts if you are listening, if you're a woman and you have a health question, or a loved one of a woman who might be going through something and you're listening and want to help her out. 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. We're back right after this. Twenty-one minutes now past 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning off a very stormy night. A lot of thunder, a lot of lightning, a lot of wind. We had some trees down in our neighborhood. Hope you're waking up happy and healthy on this Sunday morning. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. And we're inviting you to be a part of the show as well, as always, at our stylesfinancial.com talk and text line at 651-461-9226. And we have, again, Dr. Lane on our line to talk about a couple of questions that came in while we were on break. Dr. Lane, one of the callers wanted to know about when you should stop getting a mammogram. Is there an age that you stop getting a mammogram?
Right. So the recommendation is to consider stopping annual mammography at age 75. You know, this is an important discussion to have with your physician because the decision to discontinue mammography is really based on a woman's health, not just her age. So I have many patients that continue to have a mammogram beyond the age of 75 because they're healthy. Should they be diagnosed with a breast cancer, they would be able to tolerate treatment. And so while the recommendation is stopping at 75, it does not mean that women can't continue to have their annual mammogram if they're healthy enough to potentially undergo any treatment. So again, this is really a discussion that needs to happen between the patient and her provider about what's the right screening option as far as breast cancer screening for her.
Very good. Again, 651-461-9226 on our stylesfinancial.com talk and text line. Bill is calling in this morning with a question for you, Dr. Lane. Go ahead, Bill. You're on the air with the doctor.
Hey, good morning. My wife is a breast cancer survivor. My wife's sister also had breast cancer. Both tested negative for the BRCA gene. And I'm curious as to what age my daughter should be checked. She's 31 now. When should would it be rare for her to have the BRCA gene since her mother did not? Mm. And at what point, what age do you think she should get a mammogram?
Right. So I think that the recommendation for breast cancer screening in a woman with a family history is based on the age of the diagnosis of that first degree relative. So generally, if women, a mother or a sister were diagnosed with breast cancer before the age of 50, then we would recommend breast cancer screening 10 years prior to the diagnosis of that first degree relative. So for example, if your wife were diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 45, then your daughter should start breast cancer screening at 35. I think for patients with a family history such as this, you know, meeting with a genetic counselor is very important because they can then determine if, based on your family history as her father, would warrant additional genetic testing. Obviously, she gets genes from her mother and genes from you. And so that genetic counseling is extremely important in making a decision. But the first thing to do is to determine, again, the age of diagnosis of those first degree relatives and then start screening 10 years prior.
Okay, very good. Another texter just following up on that, with so many women in their 30s getting breast cancer, is there talk that the first one, you said 20, isn't it, the first one?
40.
Oh, so talk about the fact that if women are getting it in their 30s, is there any chance that the recommendation could be moved up?
Yeah, this is a tough question, and I'm not sure that there's discussion about moving the screening age up at this point. The issue oftentimes with screening younger women is that the breast tissue in younger women is often very dense. And so what happens when we screen younger women with mammography, that dense breast tissue can result in additional diagnostic imaging and or unnecessary biopsies. So whenever we have a screening test like a mammogram or a pap test, the goal is to detect as much cancer as we can as possible without having women or men undergo unnecessary testing, and diagnostic procedures that are not only anxiety provoking and sometimes uncomfortable, but also expensive. And so, it does seem as though we're hearing about breast cancer in women, in younger ages. Again, I cannot reinforce how important it is to establish with a physician that you see every year that's going to do that full exam. And women need to have awareness of their breasts. Mm-hmm. So does the skin look normal? When you get out of the shower, I think it's important that, that women take a look to make sure that there haven't been any changes. But to my knowledge, there hasn't been any discussion about changing the screening age earlier than 40 unless there's a family history.
We were talking, Dr. Lane, about the different screenings available for women. What do you think of annual or possibly getting screened for lung cancer? I know that we talk about heart disease, we talk about breast cancer. Lung cancer is among the top when it comes to death among women. What do you think of that?
Right. I think now there are a lot of screening options for, again, based on risk factors. And so this is a conversation that women that are, perhaps have been smokers or are smokers should have with their physician. Lung cancer generally isn't genetic. So a lot of times the decision to screen for lung cancer would be based on those risk factors such as smoking or exposure to substances that may increase the risk of lung cancer.
It is 7:28 now on Sunday morning. My name is Susie Jones. Our guest is Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. We are taking your questions here at 651-461-9226 on our stylesfinancial.com talk and text line. We invite you to be a part of the show, whatever you want to talk about. I know that a lot of different issues affecting women differently. And we're getting some questions, particularly one is about our weight. I know there's so much stress and so much attention to weight these days and the new weight loss medications. This person writes, is there a way to calculate BMI, body mass index, based on gender, age, etc., and the best weight? Previously, the person writes, BMI was just height and weight. Can you talk a little bit about weight and recommendations for women in that category? I know that's so complicated because it's so emotionally charged as well.
Yeah, it is emotionally charged. And I think, it's not a one size fits all. And I, have patients that are very healthy, very active, and perhaps you wouldn't classify them as thin. And so, unfortunately, we focus a lot on that number versus just being healthy. I'm not aware of any other metric besides BMI for weight. And, I think we all, in the health care community are challenged with BMI as it's not often the best way to identify patients that are obese, but that's what we often use. So I think that, again, based on your height, it is important to understand what your BMI is. Is your BMI greater because you have more muscle tone or muscle mass? Mm-hmm. In which case, a higher BMI may be completely healthy. And so, having a conversation with your physician, eating healthy. I think we are, from a cultural perspective, we have diets that are high in processed foods. We're not as active as we once were. I think incorporating exercise as much as possible and shifting to foods that are kind of in their natural state, what I call whole foods. So if they've been foods that have been processed or made in the factory are probably not the best options for us the majority of the time. So I think that if we focus on activity and healthy diets rather than just the number, I think we would feel better about ourselves. I think we'd be overall more healthier. But I do think it requires a discussion with your physician because, of course, risk factors in your family history play a role in what's the ideal weight for an individual.
All right. We are going to get a call in here before we take our bottom of the hour break. Elaine is waiting to talk to you, Dr. Lane. Elaine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Lane. I am an elderly woman, 87 years old, and in the past 5 years, my left breast has been increasing in size, and my physician had me do a mammogram, which was negative. Is that something that is common among women? With one breast increasing and not the other.
Okay. If you'll hang up and listen, that'd be great. Dr. Lane, go ahead with your answer.
Hi. Good morning. That's a great question. So we can see an asymmetry in the breast. I think it's reassuring that your mammogram was normal. But if you're troubled by the asymmetry and the breast that's larger than the other one, you could certainly request a referral to a breast surgeon or a breast specialist. Whenever women are still troubled, even after normal imaging, I think getting not necessarily a second opinion, but seeing a specialist, seeing someone that focuses on that area is extremely important. And there are breast specialists that you could see that probably see a wide variety of breast conditions that perhaps your primary OBGYN or your primary care provider does not see and can make recommendations for you. And sometimes the recommendation is just reassurance that no intervention is necessary, that everything is normal.
All right, we're going to take our bottom of the hour break. Again, our guest is Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. You are invited, encouraged to be part of the program as well at 651-461-9226. That is our Styles Financial Talk and Text line. We'll do this break with some weather and back right after this. And we are back. It is 7:36, almost 7:37. The hour is flying by today. It's a great conversation about women's health. Dr. Indy Lane is Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. And we have a lot of people with a lot of questions. So let's do that. Let's get right to some of those that we did not get earlier. This person texts, can Kegel exercises help with bladder issues in women, and how does a person know if they're working? And that question comes from a listener a short time ago. And maybe tell people what the Kegel exercise is, too, if they're unfamiliar.
Right. That's a great question. So Kegel exercises can be an important component in strengthening the pelvic floor muscles, particularly in women who are starting to experience some urinary incontinence. Oftentimes, you know, I find that patients think that, you know, Kegel exercises just mean kind of, you know, squeezing the vaginal walls. But really what you're trying to do is strengthen that muscle that helps us stop the stream of urine. So it's important if you're going to do pelvic floor exercises that you do them correctly. And what I often tell patients to do is to, when you are going to the bathroom and you're urinating, trying to squeeze to stop the stream of urine. You know, that type of exercise kind of helps to strengthen the muscle and help with some of those urinary incontinence symptoms. Depending on the severity of your symptoms, exercises alone just may not be enough. And so sometimes an evaluation from a pelvic floor physical therapist, again, sometimes women can have urinary incontinence that's not a result of something muscular. And so in that case, doing exercises will not help. Sometimes, you know, women have what we call pelvic organ relaxation or pelvic floor relaxation. And in those cases, you may not get optimal results with just a Kegel exercise. So having a pelvic exam and being evaluated, and then really that pelvic floor physical therapy and appropriate candidates can be really helpful for patients with milder symptoms of urinary incontinence.
And to follow up with that, a texter writes, can you explain pelvic prolapse and when that might require surgery? Would that be a hysterectomy? So that kind of follows with some of which that you're talking about.
Okay. Absolutely. So the pelvis is a complex, I describe it to patients as kind of an overlapping basket of muscles and nerves. inside that basket, you've got the bladder, then you have the uterus, you also have the colon, you know, rectum and intestines, and then there are tubes called ureters that carry the urine from the kidney to the bladder. All of those things are in the pelvis. When, as a result of age or childbirth, you have relaxation of those pelvic floor muscles, those pelvic organs can start to prolapse into the vagina and cause symptoms. Some women feel pressure. Some women have urinary incontinence, so they're unable to control the stream of urine. Some women, depending on the degree of pelvic organ relaxation or prolapse, can actually have obstruction of the path of urine, and they can have difficulty urinating. The pelvic organ prolapse can also affect having regular bowel movement. Sometimes it can be such that it's difficult to have a bowel movement. And so just like in the discussion we had about urinary incontinence, sometimes pelvic floor physical therapy can help with milder symptoms. There are some minimally invasive surgical options. There are also devices called pessaries. So for women that have pelvic organ prolapse, but they do not want surgery, this is a device that can be inserted into the vagina, and it kind of pushes the tissue and the vaginal tissue and the cervix or uterus back up in place and allows women to be active without that pelvic floor or that vaginal pressure. Mm. Patients can also opt to have surgery. Sometimes, again, as I mentioned, it can be minimally invasive. It sometimes will involve removing the cervix and the uterus and the ovaries. You know, it all depends on the severity and the degree of the prolapse.
Okay, very good. 651-461-9226 on our Styles Financial Talk and text line. Another texter writes today, does our immunity to virus and illness tend to weaken as we age?
Yeah, it can weaken as we age and with certain medical conditions. And so, it's important, healthy diet and exercise, maintaining a healthy weight, all of those, not smoking. All of those things play a role in our immunity. Sometimes because of, health conditions that we have or medications that we take, that decline in immunity can be accelerated. So understanding what your risk factors are for a weakened immune system is important. Again, getting plenty of sleep and eating a healthy diet and exercise are going to help fight against that, natural decline in immunity.
All right. And then maybe along those lines, maybe it's age related, maybe not. Can you address hair loss in women?
Yeah, hair loss is extremely distressing for women. I often say to patients, it takes a long time for our hair to grow and a short amount of time for our hair to fall out. And so oftentimes, dramatic changes in hair loss can be the result of hormonal changes. That can be because of pregnancy. Women often experience hair loss in the postpartum period. It can be due to the shift in hormones related to the perimenopause and menopausal transition. It can be due to thyroid conditions. You can also lose hair, interestingly enough, if you are severely anemic, especially if it comes on right away. Stress is another cause of hair loss. Really, our hair is oftentimes a reflection of our overall health. So, not to sound like a broken record, but your diet, your exercise, all of those things can play a role in hair growth and hair loss.
Great. All right. The next question comes from Elaine. She is on our newsline on our stylesfinancial.com. Not Elaine, Janet. Sorry about that. Janet, I read the wrong name right off my sheet. Go ahead. You're on.
Okay.
You're on the air with Dr. Lane. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I love your show on Sunday morning. Never miss it. Anyway, I have a question about osteopenia because I was just diagnosed with that and was wondering about a little bit about it and what would be the best treatment.
Right. So osteopenia is thinning bones, whereas osteoporosis is a more severe bone loss condition that often requires treatment. So with osteopenia, most of the time, and your physician may have discussed this with you, we recommend you know, calcium supplementation. You know, we'd like for you to get as much as you can from your diet, but oftentimes we don't as women get enough calcium. And so calcium and vitamin D supplementation is very important. Strength training and exercise. We know that weight-bearing exercise or resistance training helps build muscle. And so that's an important component of fighting against the osteopenia. And so those are things that you should incorporate in your day-to-day routine to help prevent the progression to osteoporosis. With osteopenia, most of the time, again, you know, if you don't have any other risk factors, we're going to recommend those prevention type activities to you, repeat your bone density screening test, and then not generally result or recommend treatment rather until it progresses to osteoporosis. And that's largely because no medication is without risk. And so we want to reserve the medications for osteoporosis for the women at greatest risk.
All right. It is 7:45. We're going to take our final break of the hour. But again, if you're listening, we are talking to Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Healthcare's new Vice President of Women's Health. And you can jump in if you're listening and have a question. We still have time, 651-461-9226. You can either call or text on News Talk 830 WCCO. And we're back for the final segment of the program, this hour dedicated to health. My name is Susie Jones, Charlie Weiss at the helm, and we are taking your calls and your texts at 651-461-9226. We're talking about women's health, and we have with us on our newsline Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. And Catherine is on our talk and text line with a question for the doctor. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning. I am fine. Thank you guys for taking my call.
No problem.
Yes, I have a question about ultrasound for women's breast examination. What is the difference in...
And we are back. It is 7:36, almost 7:37. The hour is flying by today. It's a great conversation about women's health. Dr. Indy Lane is Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. And we have a lot of people with a lot of questions. So let's do that. Let's get right to some of those that we did not get earlier. This person texts, can Kegel exercises help with bladder issues in women? And how does a person know if they're working? And that question comes from a listener a short time ago. And maybe tell people what the Kegel exercise is, too, if they're unfamiliar.
Right. That's a great question. So Kegel exercises can be an important component in strengthening the pelvic floor muscles, particularly in women who are starting to experience some urinary incontinence. Oftentimes, you know, I find that patients think that, you know, Kegel exercises just mean kind of, you know, squeezing the vaginal walls. But really what you're trying to do is strengthen that muscle that helps us stop the stream of urine. So it's important if you're going to do pelvic floor exercises that you do them correctly. And what I often tell patients to do is to, when you are going to the bathroom and you're urinating, trying to squeeze to stop the stream of urine. You know, that type of exercise kind of helps to strengthen the muscle and help with some of those urinary incontinence symptoms. Depending on the severity of your symptoms, exercises alone just may not be enough. And so sometimes an evaluation from a pelvic floor physical therapist, again, sometimes women can have urinary incontinence that's not a result of something muscular. And so in that case, doing exercises will not help. Sometimes, you know, women have what we call pelvic organ relaxation or pelvic floor relaxation. And in those cases, you may not get optimal results with just a Kegel exercise. So having a pelvic exam and being evaluated, and then really that pelvic floor physical therapy and appropriate candidates can be really helpful for patients with milder symptoms of urinary incontinence.
And to follow up with that, a texter writes, can you explain pelvic prolapse and when that might require surgery? Would that be a hysterectomy? So that kind of follows with some of which that you're talking about.
Okay, absolutely. So the pelvis is a complex, I describe it to patients as kind of an overlapping basket of muscles and nerves. Inside that basket, you've got the bladder, then you have the uterus, you also have the colon, rectum and intestines, and then there are tubes called ureters that carry the urine from the kidney to the bladder. All of those things are in the pelvis. When, as a result of age or childbirth, you have relaxation of those pelvic floor muscles, those pelvic organs can start to prolapse into the vagina and cause symptoms. Some women feel pressure. Some women have urinary incontinence, so they're unable to control the stream of urine. Some women, depending on the degree of pelvic organ relaxation or prolapse, can actually have obstruction of the path of urine, and they can have difficulty urinating. The pelvic organ prolapse can also affect having regular bowel movement. Sometimes it can be such that it's difficult to have a bowel movement. And so just like the discussion we had about urinary incontinence, sometimes pelvic floor physical therapy can help with milder symptoms. There are some minimally invasive surgical options. There are also devices called pessaries. So for women that have pelvic organ prolapse, but they do not want surgery, this is a device that can be inserted into the vagina, and it kind of pushes the tissue and the vaginal tissue and the cervix or uterus back up in place and allows women to be active without that pelvic floor or that vaginal pressure. Mm. Patients can also opt to have surgery. Sometimes, again, as I mentioned, it can be minimally invasive. It sometimes will involve removing the cervix and the uterus and the ovaries. It all depends on the severity and the degree of the prolapse.
Okay, very good. 651-461-9226 on our Stiles Financial Talk and text line. Another texter writes today, does our immunity to virus and illness tend to weaken as we age?
Yeah, it can weaken as we age and with certain medical conditions. And so, it's important, healthy diet and exercise, maintaining a healthy weight, all of those, not smoking. All of those things play a role in our immunity. Sometimes because of, health conditions that we have or medications that we take, that decline in immunity can be accelerated. So understanding what your risk factors are for a weakened immune system is important. Again, getting plenty of sleep and eating a healthy diet and exercise are going to help fight against that, natural decline in immunity.
All right. And then maybe along those lines, maybe it's age related, maybe not. Can you address hair loss in women?
Yeah, hair loss is extremely distressing for women. I often say to patients, it takes a long time for our hair to grow and a short amount of time for our hair to fall out. And so oftentimes, dramatic changes in hair loss can be the result of hormonal changes. That can be because of pregnancy. Women often experience hair loss in the postpartum period. It can be due to the shift in hormones related to the perimenopause and menopausal transition. It can be due to thyroid conditions. You can also lose hair, interestingly enough, if you are severely anemic, especially if it comes on right away. Stress is another cause of hair loss. Really, our hair is oftentimes a reflection of our overall health. So, not to sound like a broken record, but your diet, your exercise, all of those things can play a role in hair growth and hair loss.
Great. All right. The next question comes from Elaine. She is on our newsline on our stylesfinancial.com. Not Elaine, Janet. Sorry about that. Janet, I read the wrong name right off my sheet. Go ahead. You're on.
Okay.
You're on the air with Dr. Lane. Sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
ahead.
Thank you. I love your show on Sunday morning. Never miss it. Anyway, I have a question about osteopenia because I was just diagnosed with that and was wondering about a little bit about it and what would be the best treatment.
Right. So osteopenia is thinning bones, whereas osteoporosis is a more severe bone loss condition that often requires treatment. So with osteopenia, most of the time, and your physician may have discussed this with you, we recommend calcium supplementation. You know, we'd like for you to get as much as you can from your diet, but oftentimes we don't as women get enough calcium. And so calcium and vitamin D supplementation is very important. Strength training and exercise, we know that weight-bearing exercise or resistance training helps build muscle. And so that's an important component of fighting against the osteopenia. And so those are things that you should incorporate in your day-to-day routine to help prevent the progression to osteoporosis. With osteopenia, most of the time, if you don't have any other risk factors, we're going to recommend those prevention-type activities to you, repeat your bone density screening test, and then not generally recommend treatment, rather, until it progresses to osteoporosis. And that's largely because no medication is without risk. And so we want to reserve the medications for osteoporosis for the women at greatest risk.
All right. It is 7:45. We're going to take our final break of the hour. But again, if you're listening, we are talking to Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Healthcare's new Vice President of Women's Health. And you can jump in if you're listening and have a question. We still have time, 651-461-9226. You can either call or text on News Talk 830 WCCO. And we're back for the final segment of the program, this hour dedicated to health. My name is Susie Jones, Charlie Weiss at the helm, and we are taking your calls and your texts at 651-461-9226. We're talking about women's health, and we have with us on our newsline Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. And Catherine is on our talk and text line with a question for the doctor. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning. I am fine. Thank you guys for taking my call.
No problem.
Yes, I have a question about ultrasound for women's breast examination. What is the difference, and is it better? I just want to know that.
Yeah, that's great. Great question, because I think that's different from the regular one.
Yeah. Good morning, Catherine. It is a great question. So oftentimes we utilize ultrasound when we can feel a mass in the breast. It's often difficult to locate the really tiny changes that we can see with a mammogram with the ultrasound. So just doing an ultrasound of the breast is not considered the gold standard for breast cancer screening because, again, it's not going to detect those really early cancers like a mammogram can. But it is a great modality if you are doing a breast exam and you notice a mass. We often will evaluate that mass with an ultrasound.
All right. Let's get a couple in here quickly before we run out of time. This does actually go to the question that Catherine had, and that is there a breast specialist title that you can find one, or is that part of your – I'll leave it there. Is there a breast specialist?
Yeah, so there are breast surgeons that if you have an abnormal mammogram or you have a certain condition, mastitis or an infection of the breast, or if you have a benign mass, so you've had a mammogram, they've identified a mass that is likely not a cancer, but a woman may consider surgical intervention. You can see a breast surgeon. And I consider those physicians breast specialists.
Okay.
And they understand how to read the mammogram, and what interventions may be necessary. They also see conditions, you know, much like we talked about earlier, where there's asymmetry or, again, there's an infection. So I would consider the breast surgeons the breast specialist.
Okay, good. Let's get a couple more in if we can. Is it normal for a woman's blood pressure to rise as we age? And what is an acceptable number, in your opinion?
Right. So, yes. Oftentimes, you know, women can experience increased blood pressure or hypertension with age, and that's because the blood vessels become less pliable as we age. And so that can make the blood pressure high. The vessels don't contract and relax the way they do when we're younger. You know, and again, this is where understanding your personal history and your family history is critical in determining what is the appropriate range for your blood pressure. So in general, we want your blood pressure to be 120 over 80 or less. And again, depending on your family history or personal history, your physician may recommend a different range for you. So having that discussion and understanding your history is critical.
Okay. And as we wrap up here, we have about a minute left. I just want you to talk a little bit about Women's Health and Allina Health. I know you guys take kind of a holistic approach to women's health. Can you briefly explain that and how people can find out more information?
Right. So, you know, Allina offers a wide variety of treatment options for women. I think that what I'm so excited about the conversations that are happening about women's health because, you know, there are different facets of a woman's life. We are more than just the childbearing years. And also there are women that are seeking integrative medicine options. And so Allina offers that. For those women that are of childbearing age or have high-risk pregnancies, I think Allina's perinatologists have excellent, comprehensive, multidisciplinary care coordination that allows for women to have very individualized care when they have a high-risk pregnancy, particularly those pregnancies that are complicated by cardiovascular disease or diabetes. And so it's important, again, to find that provider and discuss those important issues related to your women's health.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Lane. You were outstanding. We'll definitely have you on again some Sunday morning. Dr. Andy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health on WCCO.
Thank you.
And we're back for the final segment of the program, this hour dedicated to health. My name is Susie Jones, Charlie Weiss at the helm, and we are taking your calls and your texts at 651-461-9226. We're talking about women's health, and we have with us on our newsline Dr. Indy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health. And Catherine is on our talk and text line with a question for the doctor. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning. I am fine. Thank you guys for taking my call.
No problem.
Yes, I have a question about ultrasound for women's breast examination. What is the difference and is it better? I just want to know that.
Yeah, that's great. Great question because I think that's different from the regular one.
Yeah, good morning, Catherine. It is a great question. So oftentimes we utilize ultrasound when we can feel a mass in the breast. It's often difficult to locate the really tiny changes that we can see with a mammogram with the ultrasound. So just doing an ultrasound of the breast is not considered the gold standard for breast cancer screening because, again, it's not going to detect those really early cancers like a mammogram can. But it is a great modality. If you are doing a breast exam and you notice a mass, we often will evaluate that mass with an ultrasound.
All right. Let's get a couple in here quickly before we run out of time. This does actually go to the question that Catherine had, and that is there a breast specialist title that you can find one, or is that part of your – I'll leave it there. Is there a breast specialist?
Yeah, so there are breast surgeons that if you have an abnormal mammogram or you have a certain condition, mastitis or an infection of the breast, or if you have a benign mass, so you've had a mammogram, they've identified a mass that is likely not a cancer, but a woman may consider surgical intervention. You can see a breast surgeon. And I consider those physicians breast specialists.
Okay.
And they understand how to read the mammogram, And what interventions may be necessary. They also see conditions, you know, much like we talked about earlier, where there's asymmetry or, again, there's an infection. So I would consider the breast surgeons the breast specialists.
Okay, good. Let's get a couple more in if we can. Is it normal for a woman's blood pressure to rise as we age? And what is an acceptable number, in your opinion?
Right. So, yes. Oftentimes, you know, women can experience increased blood pressure or hypertension with age, and that's because the blood vessels become less pliable as we age, and so that can make the blood pressure high. The vessels don't contract and relax the way they do when we're younger. You know, and again, this is where understanding your personal history and your family history is critical in determining what is the appropriate range for your blood pressure. So in general, we want your blood pressure to be 120 over 80 or less. And again, depending on your family history or personal history, your physician may recommend a different range for you. So having that discussion and understanding your history is critical.
Okay. And as we wrap up here, we have about a minute left. I just want you to talk a little bit about Women's Health and Allina Health. I know you guys take kind of a holistic approach to women's health. Can you briefly explain that and how people can find out more information?
Right. So, you know, Allina offers a wide variety of treatment options for women. I think that what I'm so excited about the conversations that are happening about women's health because, you know, there are different facets of a woman's life. We are more than just the childbearing years. And also there are women that are seeking integrative medicine options. And so Allina offers that for those women that are of childbearing age or have high-risk pregnancies. I think Allina's perinatologists have excellent, comprehensive, multidisciplinary care coordination that allows for women to have very individualized care when they have a high-risk pregnancy, particularly those pregnancies that are complicated by cardiovascular disease or diabetes. And so it's important, again, to find that provider and discuss those important issues related to your women's health.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Lane. You were outstanding. We'll definitely have you on again some Sunday morning. Dr. Andy Lane, Allina Health's new Vice President of Women's Health on WCCO.
Thank you.